Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Here at Stonebridge, our goal is to lead people into a real, healthy, and growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to join us live, we hold services every Sunday at 9:30 and 11:05 a.m. at 1 Stonebridge Church Drive in the Woodlands, Texas. We invite you to check out our website at gostonebridge.com and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is at SBChurch, and give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/gostonebridge. This week, Pastor Steve Bradley teaches from his new series, Easter, A New Ending. Here's Pastor Steve.
Because we talk about new beginnings and how, you know, Christ made us new and how he gave us a new beginning. But when you really look at Easter, you know, as we started looking at it, we realized that what was so powerful about Easter was not that it, you know, the new beginning, but the fact that the new ending to the story. Because what happens with us is we look at our lives and we go through things and we face things. And we're sort of, you know, faced with this inevitable ending that we think is not really good. And when Jesus came and Jesus lived his life, you know, Jesus brought all these new endings to people's lives, which is what makes us, you know, have a new beginning or look at our life in a totally different way because of how Jesus taught us that it was going to end because of him rather than just us. And it sort of brings us to this one struggle that we all have that is really addressed in Easter, and especially at the story of Easter, and that is that there is also, you know, if you're going to follow Jesus and you're going to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that God sent him into the world, you know, to make a difference, then you also realize, all of us know this, that you also realize there's a cost involved, right? There is a cost involved, and that's where a lot of people struggle. They say, now, wait a minute, hold on, I don't understand about this idea that it's going to cost me, and I've been around Christians before, and, you know, I look at them, and it does cost them, and, you know, I'm afraid, you know, that if I become a Christian and I'm going to go to church, there's going to be a cost because they pass an offering plate or something like that, and all of a sudden, you know, if you're a Christian, there are these things that you say, you know, I used to do that, I don't do that anymore, I used to go there, be involved in those things, I used to sort of live my life this way, I don't really live my life that way anymore, and there is this cost, and the reality is, of course there is. Because if there's a new ending to your life, if you believe that it doesn't end because of Jesus the way it ended before, you approach life differently. You have to approach life differently. And if you look in the Bible and you look at the stories of the people in the Bible, that is exactly what happened to them. They didn't live the same way that they lived before. Why? Because they believed that they trusted Jesus and they followed Jesus. There was a totally new ending to life. And I want you to think about this for a minute. That changes then how you see and how you understand life and what you're trying to get out of life. And where it really changes things is how much of life you have to try to control yourself and make it happen the way you want it to happen rather than, you know, be able to believe that you know, God is going to take care of things and that Christ came to give us something that we could never give ourselves. And that's where the cost comes in. There's where the cost comes in. You see, if you go all the way back to the very beginning, sin, you could characterize sin as this. Sin is me saying, I want my way, my plans, how I figure it out, you know, how I've kind of worked it out, rather than, you know, yielding to or listening to and saying, but God has his way and his plans and how he wants it to work out. And God made us and he invites us into this way because the reality is he's going to win anyway. You know, it's going to go his way, but we tend to fight that and to struggle with that. And if you look even in Genesis, you know, with Adam and Eve, that was the temptation. Why would you take God's way? Why would you trust him? Why would you follow his plans and listen to, you know, what he wants you to do and even pay the cost or the price that God wants you to pay? Because there's one tree in the garden. You're not even allowed to eat of that one tree. You know, why would you do that when you could have your way? You could have your plans. Life could turn out the way you want it to turn out. And there's this deception that is brought in that you can control life yourself and have it your way. And we all live our lives and say, well, a certain amount of that is true. I have to make my own choice. Yeah. But the question is, where does that end if you go that route? If you chase that, you know, that that ring, you know, where is that going to end? What's going to happen if you keep living your life that way? And that's what I want to deal with this morning with you. And I want to get you, if you would, to look at a a story, actually it's a pretty long story, about a guy named Lazarus. And most of us remember Lazarus because he is the guy in the Bible that Jesus did what with Lazarus? He did what? He raised him from the dead. That's right. And his story is told in John chapter 11 and 12, and it's in your outline. Not all of it because I couldn't get it all in there. And so if you have a Bible and you want to turn to John chapter 11, you might want to make notes there because I know the outline didn't have as much space this morning to make some notes as you think about John's story. But let me set it up for you because this is a really, really powerful story. In fact, in John's story, this will pop up on the screen. It's in your outline. In John's story, this is the one event that becomes a really, really big turning point for those who decide they're going to believe in Jesus and they're going to follow him, and those people who instead decided that the cost was too high to believe and to follow Jesus. And Lazarus' story is a big deal in that. So let me set it up for you this way. Lazarus is part of a family. Lazarus has two sisters. Do you know their names? Their names are both start with an M. Mary and, yeah, and they live in Bethany, which is not very far from Jerusalem. In fact, it's just on the other side of the Mount of Olives. They were a very prosperous family. They were wealthy, they were prominent, but they were a family who loved Jesus, and Jesus loved them, and he often went and he stayed with them in their home, and they had decided that they believed him and they trusted him, and there's a lot of stories with Mary and Martha as they're learning to do this, and they cared for Jesus deeply. But in this story also, they're right next to the chief religious city in Israel called Jerusalem. And there are people there who live there also, and they are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We all just say that, you know, they weren't as happy as the Pharisees. That's why they're called the Sadducees. No, and just honestly, there were just like two different political parties. Makes it relate to us, right? You know, like two different political parties. The Pharisees was a larger group. They were the most loved. They were the most pious. In fact, they were the most, I love to say this, they were the most theologically correct group there was. I mean, they worked hard at all the rules and the laws. The Sadducees were a smaller group. They were much, usually wealthier. They collaborated much more with the Romans than the Pharisees did. So, you know, whatever party you want, political party you want to associate all that stuff with, I'll leave that to your business. And then there was this third group, and they would meet with them, and they were called the scribes and the Pharisees. They were the teachers of the religious law, and they were like the justices. They were like the Supreme Court. And they would all get together, and they would meet together to make really important decisions, and they would battle and kind of fight against each other, and they had different aspirations. And each of them was doing this one thing because they were powerful people. They were wealthy people. They were people who had position. Each of the groups was trying to get their own political will done, right? How they saw it. How they decided that it would work out the best. And they're in this battle as we're all in this battle to get that. Then there's this other group of people called the Romans. And the Romans, if you know history 2,000 years ago, the Romans had conquered this part of the world, as they'd conquered most of the world, and they ruled over it, they owned it, and their will, they made sure their will was the will that was imposed on all people. They put up with the Jews, they put up with the religious leaders, they gave them a certain amount of power and position for a lot of different reasons, but they decided it would work out the best if they did that. But they made sure that you understood that when Rome made a decision, the will of Rome would be done. And so they had instituted, works really well coming up on Easter, this they had adopted this form of punishment that was designed to let you know no one opposes Rome without paying the price. There is a cost to oppose Rome because Rome will win, Rome will impose their will. And so they instituted this method of death called what? Crucifixion, right. And it was designed to be horrible. It was designed to strike fear into the hearts of the people so that the people would not oppose them. In fact, before Jesus, or around the time Jesus is born, there's an instant where Rome has to come into Jerusalem, and they crucify in one day, 2,000 Jews in just one day. Didn't crucify him up on a hill. They would crucify him on the road. They just put crosses lining all the roads coming into Jerusalem because they wanted you to know, you oppose Rome, you lose. Rome's will be instituted, and Rome's will be purposed in life. Now, all of them were battling for this one thing, and I know you may think this is kind of strange, but they were all battling for this one thing, which all controlling kind of entities battle for. They were all battling for the will and the affection and the cooperation, not of God, but of the people. That's what they were battling for. The Sadducees and the Pharisees, they knew if the people opposed them, they couldn't move things very well. The Romans understood, even with their fear tactics and all their weaponry and their armies, they also understood they needed the will of the people to be with them, and they just instituted it with fear. Jesus comes along, and Jesus is a problem. And the reason Jesus is a problem is because the people love Jesus. They heard a totally different story. They came up with an entirely different connection because of who Jesus was. And Mary and Martha and Lazarus was one of these families that just loved Jesus. They loved to listen to him. They saw a new connection that through Jesus they understood we can know and follow and believe and live the will of God himself. And it's much better than trying to live the will of man, even to live, you know, which is our struggle, my struggle too, my own will. But there's a cost, right? There's a cost. Because I have to surrender even my will, my plans, my desires, you know, if I'm going to follow after and live God's plans and God's will and God's desires. Now listen, even in our day, there are a lot of us, and I completely understand, what we're looking for, what we'd really like, is a God that says, I am here, I am powerful, I can do whatever I want, and I will help you get your plans, your will, your dreams. That's actually not what he offered. He actually offered something better. He says, I'm offering that you can have God's plans and God's will and God's dreams in your life, and that you can follow him. But it will cost you. You will have to not spend your whole life trying to chase and impose and force your will in life, but instead to give yourself to him. And that was really the life of Jesus. And that was the whole point of coming up on his crucifixion, all this. Let me tell you that one of the things I like about the Gospels, and especially I like the Gospel of John, is because it is told from the standpoint of a writer. And he's not writing this as it's going along. This is John writing much later in life, and he's looking back and he's realizing, if I don't write it down and if I don't send out these letters, it could be missed, or someone could twist the truth around and they could miss who Jesus really was. And he's writing it. So some of, even in his writing, he is talking about things he knows later, and he's kind of inferring some things. This is how it worked out. But most of it, he's just trying to say, this is actually what happened. And this is why it's such a powerful story. Because if you read the story and you read the Gospels, you will notice that they don't all match up exactly on all the details and things. And the reason is because four people are not from different places going to tell the same story, and all the details match up. And if you get hung up, and I've seen people do this before, they get hung up on, you know, so was Jesus, you know, was he wearing a robe, a linen robe, did it have green lace on it, or did it have blue lace on it? You know, and if one says blue and one says green, well, you can't trust the Bible. That, listen, if they all said exactly the same thing in the same details, you can't trust it. Because that means it was edited, it was changed. They got together and they agreed on all the details, not because they saw everything the same way, but because all the details, you know, they thought had to be in line if we're creating a false narrative. But they tell their story from their perspective, and what they saw and what they understood, or sometimes what they were told or what they heard, and all the details don't match up exactly right, but the story absolutely matches up, and it makes it even more powerful when you read this story. So all that was just kind of an introduction and set up to John chapter 11, and I'm going to jump into the story. This is after Lazarus has died. And rather than jump in the very first, which I'll go back to the very first, I want to jump in kind of the part of the story. It's down in verse 45 of chapter 11, because this is the impact of the story. It says, many of the people, this is verse 45 in John chapter 11, many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. They're talking about the resurrection of Lazarus, that he is raised from the dead. It says, but some went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. You know, he raised this guy. And then the leading priests and the Pharisees, here's the conflict, they called the high council together. That's the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the chief scribes and lawyers. He says, what are we going to do? They each ask each other. This man certainly performs many miraculous signs. They all agreed on this. Many of them had seen these signs. If we allow him to go on like this, this is what I want you to catch, because this is all of our struggle. If we allow him to go on like this, we allow these things to continue to happen, soon, catch this. In fact, say this part with me. Soon, what will happen? Everyone will what? We can't have that. Because if everyone believes in him and everyone follows him, what happens to our position? What happens to our power? What happens to our authority? What happens to our wealth? We cannot allow this to happen. Then the Roman army will come and destroy both our temple and our nation. So if you look at it and you listen to it, you say, you know, actually, but it makes a lot of sense. Who wants the Romans to destroy their nation? And we can't have the Romans, you know, coming and destroying the temple, because the temple is so important as far as our worship and our relationship to God. And then it says in verse 49, Caiaphas was the high priest at the time. Now, Caiaphas is part of a family, and he is the high priest at the time in a very, very powerful political family who is a part of the Sanhedrin. He would have been a Pharisee, and Caiaphas, his whole family kind of controlled it, and every time there was a new vote for a new high priest, you know, they knew how to bargain and how to give favors, just like any political system, and to make sure that their family stayed in power. So this is Caiaphas, very smart man, very powerful man, and this is what he said. You don't know what you're talking about. I like that. You know, this is what smart and powerful men do. They come up and just say, y'all are all stupid. You have no idea what you're talking about. You don't even understand what we're dealing with and what's going on. He says, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't realize that it's better for you, catch this, because they just said a lot of good things about Jesus. It's better for you that one man should die for the people than the whole nation to be destroyed. Now, of all the people that knew the law, and they knew what God had said, and they knew about, you know, guilty and innocent, and they understood that there was a price to pay if you went against God and God's law. This group knew. But Caiaphas is saying, listen, you are just not politically astute. You just don't understand how it needs to work. Even if Jesus is innocent, even if Jesus has done many miraculous signs, even if the people love Jesus and follow Jesus, it would be better for one innocent, powerful, loving, you know, healing, you know, man who raises people from the dead, it would be better that this one man dies than for us to lose our power. That's what he's saying, for us to lose our position. For the Romans to come in and overturn, you know, our structure and our system. Because let me remind you again, the Pharisees, they had their power because the Romans allowed it. In most cultures, they would not have allowed a group like this to remain in power because, you know, of the threat of them. But they had learned how to cooperate and how to work with Rome. And many times when there were uprisings among the Jews and the Romans had to put them down, many times those were opposed by the religious leaders because they knew what would happen. They knew that Rome would impose its will. So we're going to work underneath the will of Rome, and underneath that we want our kind of cut and our will and our power and our position. Then it says in verse 51, catch this. This is why this stuff is so real. He says, he did not say this on his own. As high priest at the time, he was led to prophesy that Jesus would die for the entire nation. He didn't understand what he's saying, right? He says, you guys don't know anything. And the truth is, the John is saying, Caiaphas doesn't know anything. If he understood what he was saying and the word that he was giving, he would have thought twice. This is in verse 52. And not only for that nation, but to bring together and unite all the children of God scattered around the world. So John is looking back, right, as he writes this and says Caiaphas was prophesying about who Jesus was and what Jesus was actually going to do. And Caiaphas didn't even know what he was doing. You know what that says? There was a power, right? There was God himself, you know, moving and ruling over things and imposing, kind of like, you know, what he was afraid of Rome, God imposing his will and his desire over the events that, you know, that they were experiencing and the things that they were going through. And it says in verse 53, so from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. So here's his plan. He says, you guys, if, you know, you need a leader. You got to listen to me. We've got to make sure this guy dies or we will lose the affection and the attention of all the people, and that would be disastrous for this. So let me go back. Let me just read for you back in verse number one. Let me show you how this story kind of unfolded because it's really an important story as it sets up Easter for us. It says in verse number one, a man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany, and I told you that's on the other side of the Mount of Olives, right next to Jerusalem, with his sisters Mary and Martha. This was the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. So the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. Now, Jesus is not in this area at the time. He has left this area. In fact, in this same chapter, the disciples will reference the fact that we had to leave this area because Jesus, don't you remember, they were trying to stone you, so we needed to get out of there. Otherwise, you know, you'd be dead and the whole movement would die. And it looked like, you know, that Jesus agreed with that because Jesus left and they went off to another area. And so they're sending word to him to say, here's a problem. Your dear friend, he is very sick. But look at verse number four. It says, but when Jesus heard about it, he said, here's Jesus' plan and Jesus' thinking. Lazarus' sickness, in fact, say this with me because this is really cool. He says, Lazarus' sickness will not, what is the word? End in death. And of course, they're thinking, you didn't go to medical school, you know. We've seen things like, you don't understand. They would not be sending word, Jesus, if Lazarus wasn't really sick. I mean, this is a dangerous thing. Yes, and you have to go. But Jesus is saying, no, his sickness will not end in death. No, it happened, catch this, for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. So although Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and he knows, you know, they're thinking, well, if you love us, you'll come right away. That's why we're sending word really quick. Even though it says he loved them, he stayed where he was for the next, how long? Two more days. And honestly, if you read in the narrative, and you can read in the rest of the chapter, the disciples, they're kind of like, this is not going to turn out really well. And they have a hard time understanding why Jesus would delay, except that Jesus does understand that, you know, that the Jews and the Jewish leaders, especially in Jerusalem, were trying to stone him and trying to make sure that they eliminated him. And I love this. You'd have to go back and read this. I love this. If after they do this, Jesus is determined after 2 days, though, to go to Bethany, right next to Jerusalem, right next to the danger zone. And they're trying to talk him out of it, saying, it's not a good idea. We really shouldn't go back there. And a guy named Thomas, you remember him as later called Doubting Thomas, but here he's referred to as Thomas the Twin or Thomas Didymus. Thomas does what I call the Eeyore thing, you know, and like Winnie the Pooh. He kind of goes, when they finally realize Jesus is determined to go back to Jerusalem, to go to Bethany, he says, okay, he's determined to go back, so let's just go with him and we'll all die together. You know, it's kind of like the pessimist, you know, I knew it. I knew it wasn't going to end well. It's going to all be over. And that's exactly what he says. You can read it for yourself in there. This real life stuff. He's like, man, it's over, you know. We're going to all die. It's going to be done. The movement's going to be over with. It was good while it lasted, but, you know, it just didn't work out. But, you know, we're with him, and so let's go ahead and let's go die with him. Then it says in verse number 38, this is when Jesus actually gets there. It says, Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb. Now, I don't know how to go into all that. It says that he was disturbed. He was angry. You know, there's a lot of speculation. Why is Jesus angry? What is he upset about? And I'll let you kind of deal with that one. Go read some commentaries on that. So he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across the entrance. And here's what Jesus says. He says, "Roll the stone aside," Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, she protests, "Lord, he has been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible." And I told you last week in the King James, the official version says, you know, if we roll aside the stone, it won't work well because it what?
Stinketh.
It stinketh. Okay, I just want to make sure that you understood that that's, you know, and that's this is not going to be good, you know. The body's been in there a long time. This is not very smart. But Jesus responded in verse 40, "Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe?" Now, listen, that means if you do the things I ask you to do, if you trust me, when I ask you to move the stone, if you roll the stone aside and you trust me, didn't I tell you that you would see the glory of God? And he even said earlier, this is why this is going to happen, so that you would see the glory of God and you would see who the Son of Man was. Because when you see that, all of a sudden, you're in conflict. Do I follow him or do I follow what I want? Do the things that seem to give me power, position, and prestige? Or do I say, no, you know what, I've changed where I put my trust. I trust him. And Mary and Martha trusted Jesus. In fact, you see this borne out for them because in the next verse it says, verse 41, so they did what? They rolled the stone aside. They haven't moved. Now, they were wealthy. They could afford professional mourners, which we, as we read in the stories, that's what was there. Lazarus has died. It's just part of the culture, and there are all these people there, even people who are paid to cry and wail there. I know it sounds strange, you know, to us, but, you know, that's just part of their culture. And when this stone is rolled aside because Jesus is requesting it, listen, the whole scene would have changed. It would have been just so quiet you could have heard, you know, a pin drop. I mean, because here's the question. When that stone is rolled aside, now what's he going to do? Now what's he going to say? Because you're kind of, you know, when you do this, you're kind of caught in the moment, right? Something's got to happen. You can't just have them roll the stone aside and then say, oh, that wasn't a good idea. Put the stone back. Or you can't ask, you know, hey, does somebody got any Febreze with them? Because this, you know. Or I just wanted to roll the stone aside to show you that you can do a lot of things that you didn't think you could do. You're stronger than you can roll a stone, you know. What wasn't about anything like that. He set himself up. That stone is rolled aside, and Jesus, it doesn't say, you know, at this point, he's sweating, you know, great drops of sweat because he's wondering what will happen or whatever. Jesus absolutely knows what he's going to do. He is absolutely confident. He has a plan, right? He is unfolding his plan before their eyes, and that's why this story is so powerful and so dangerous, because this is the last straw. When Jesus does this, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the people in power said, that did it. That's it. We're not taking it anymore. It's one thing for him to speak and teach, and I know he healed sick people, and lame people are walking, and blind people are seeing, but, you know, when he did this, they realized we have got to do something because he's got the people with him, because no one has ever done anything like this. Look at what Jesus says. Here's what it says, the very next verse, or the second half of that verse. Then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, catch this, Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me. But I said it out loud. So he says this, you know, in front of them as he's praying. I said it out loud for the sake of all these people standing here, so that they will believe you what? Yeah, they'll believe that you sent me. You see why this was so critical? Because Jesus is saying, listen, this is the thing that's going to kind of, you know, cause them to have confidence like they've never had before. When Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. Because if Jesus can raise a man from the dead, I want to follow him. I want whatever he has. I want to go wherever he is going. Because death is the ultimate enemy. Death is the ultimate punishment. And if he is more powerful than death, if he can command even death, if he can command life back into a person, listen, that's what I want. That's what I'm looking for. If you look down in the very next chapter, chapter 12, it says this is 6 days before the Passover celebration began. Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Mary served, and Lazarus was among those who ate with him. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard. That's one of those new health things, you know, the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it, wiping his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would soon betray him, said, "The perfume was worth a year's wages." Yeah, because they were a wealthy family. They could afford it. "It should have been sold and the money given to the poor." Not that he cared for the poor. So this is, you know, John looking back and understanding, you know, who Judas was. He was a thief. And since he was in charge of the disciples' money, he often stole some for himself. Jesus replied, "Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." When all the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus, the man Jesus had raised from the dead. Because this is a big deal, not just to see Jesus, but to see Lazarus. Then the leading priests decided, catch this, to kill Lazarus too. Not only does Jesus have to go, listen, Lazarus got to go too. Because we don't want the people always running into Lazarus and saying, you know, I remember when he died, I was there at the funeral, and he'd been in the grave, and you know, because that would bring them back to believing in Jesus. "For it was because of him that many of the people had," catch this, "deserted them," right? This is their will, their wants, you know, they're to pay a price if Jesus is who he says. They deserted them and believed in him. So here's the final question I kind of want to throw at you. So how are they going to pull this off? Because one of the things that Rome would not do is they would not allow the Jews to put someone to death. That was a power they reserved for themselves. And they reserved it because it was the part of this great fear of Rome. And it was also a way to let the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders that they allowed them to have power in Israel, but to also say, yeah, but you have power only as we allow you to have power. So they put some limitations on them. And here's the question: how are they gonna move Rome? How are they gonna convince Rome that Jesus is actually a threat to them? Because if they can't convince Rome, they can't put him to death. But again, Caiaphas and the religious leaders, very smart people. They understood that Rome needed the people with them. They understood that those who served Rome in this area also had to serve Rome in Rome, you know, and those guys didn't like problems. They didn't like to hear that things weren't going well. And so here, this is a couple of chapters later in chapter 19. This is what it says in verse 12. "Then Pilate tried to release him." Now, Pilate, this is not the same, you know, guys as way back like the early Herod, and then there's a later Herod. This is a guy that lives at the time of Jesus when he's doing his ministry. Pilate is the governor of this area. And Pilate is very political, very smart, but he's also very ruthless. Not as bad as Herod, but he's still a pretty ruthless guy. Pilate tried to release him, you know, when they bring him and they try to say this guy's guilty. But the Jewish leaders shouted, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar." So they're threatening to send it back to Caesar and saying, listen, you know, here's what Pilate did, and here's the reasoning. Anyone who declares himself a king is a rebel against Caesar. So what they're going to try to do is convince Pilate that Jesus is declared himself as a king, and if you let there be another king except Caesar, that's treason, just like Jesus is a traitor saying he's a king. You can't let this go. And Pilate finds himself, it's a great story, Pilate just finds himself caught. Because Pilate says, listen, he's not guilty. I've talked to him. I've tried him. There's nothing, you know, as far as who Jesus is, that is a problem for Rome. There's a problem for me. We are not offended at all. But it's the Jewish leaders who say, yeah, but we are offended by him because he's taken away the people. And he says he's a king. And now all of a sudden Pilate's kind of called. Ooh, that would not be good for that to get all the way back to Rome. If I'm going to keep my position and my power and my wealth, my will, my desires, my plans, it's not going to work out really well. So they've got him and they're twisting his arm and it's working really well. And it says down in verse 15 that Pilate finally says, away with him. And they yelled, crucify him. Crucify your king, Pilate said. We have no king. This is the religious leaders. We have no king but who? Are you kidding me? We have no king. We have no king but Caesar, they shouted back. And Pilate turned Jesus over to them to be crucified. See, all of us struggle with this same thing, counting the cost. Because we want what we want. And we twist things and we manipulate things to say, this is what I want. This is what is important to me. I want my power. I want my will. I want my plans. I want to do the things that I want to do. And whenever someone became a follower of Jesus Christ, that this is the one thing they had to turn back over. To say, I want your will. I want your plans. And it makes sense, right? He healed. He fixed things that no one else could fix. When someone died, he raised that person from the dead. And even the plan that Jesus is about to go through, even though they don't understand it, even the disciples look at it and say, that's not really fitting into how we thought it was going to end, how it was going to work out. But afterwards, even when John is writing this, afterwards John's looking back and said, but it really did work out. It was a better plan. It was a better ending than I could ever have thought up or come up with, all because God is more powerful. God is smarter than the smartest here. God is more loving. God is more compassionate. God's plan really does work out better than my plan, or the plan of the religious leaders, or the plan of Rome, who, you know, offered protection if you just bow down to, you know, it really works out so much better, and God is going to work his plan because he's smarter, he's bigger, he's more powerful. He's going to work out his plan. He's also more loving and more compassionate. But there is a cost. It's always a cost. Something that we have to yield back to God and say, God, I trust you. I trust your plans. Trust your will. Let's pray together. Lord, as we approach Easter, this is for us who are believers, who follow you, this is the most pivotal week of our year. As we remember what you did and who you are, we remember that your plans were better than our plans. And that the cost that you ask us to pay by yielding our will and our desires to you was so small compared to the gain, compared to what we got out of it, life. That this new ending that we saw in Jesus really was a new beginning for us, a new way to understand things, a new way to face our struggles, our circumstances, the things that we don't catch and we don't understand and we don't know how to fix them and we don't know how to manipulate them in the way that we would like things to work out. Lord, this said, Easter said, you can be trusted. That your plans are better. That no matter what we face, even the Romes in our life or the Caiaphas in our life, that their plans and their desires are not as trustworthy as your plans and your desires. It says that you know exactly what you're doing. And Father, we thank you that Jesus came to this earth. He lived a life, a very real life. And that Jesus would not yield. He would not turn left, right, any other direction, no matter what he faced. But he came and he did what he planned to do, to give his life, to set us free, so that we could know you, we could trust you, we could follow you, and we would know that in doing that, we would know exactly where this is going to end. If you're here this morning, you've never put your hope and your trust in Jesus Christ. We all know it's a struggle. We all understand there's a cost involved in saying, I believe and I trust in him. But if you're here and you've never done that, what a great time to say, God, I thank you that you sent Jesus. I thank you that I can trust him with my life. And no matter what happens, I can know that his love and his forgiveness and his power is what will set me free. It is a new beginning, a new approach to life. Jesus, come live in my heart. Come lead me and guide me. Come give me the strength. Give me the strength to be willing to pay the price to follow you, to know you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.